Welcome to the No Shame On You podcast, your go-to for eliminating stigma surrounding mental health challenges. Join us for heartwarming stories, expert tips, and a community that thrives on compassion. Let's erase shame and embrace change together.
Welcome to the No Shame On You podcast. I'm Wendy Singer, Executive Director, and we have a wonderful guest today. Robin Harris is joining us from Baltimore, Maryland, where she is a licensed acupuncturist who practices through a lens of body positivity in the Roland Park neighborhood of Baltimore, to be specific, in case we have any Baltoronians who are listening. Is that right? Is that what you call it, a Baltoronian?
We'd say Baltimorean.
If there's any Baltimoreans listening, it's in the Roland Park neighborhood. But Robin also, I have known most of my life, and she is my stepsister, and she's so smart, and she's such a wonderful human. And, you know, on our mental health podcast, we talk about anything related to mental health and well-being, and millions of Americans have an eating disorder at some point in their lifetime. So Robin's focus on well-being through acupuncture and body positivity is something that I thought would be so interested in discussing. So welcome, Robin. Tell us about you. Fill us in.
Thank
more.
You. Thanks for having me. I'm 46 years old. I grew up around the corner from Wendy. So I've actually known her my whole life because she's 2 years older than me. And our parents are married, yes. And that's really fun that we get to be family. My pronouns are she and her. Before I talk about my story, I always like to just state my current privileges so that people understand where I'm speaking from. So I'm a white cisgender woman. I wear straight sizes and clothes. And what that means is there's a whole spectrum, but I can walk into a store and find clothes readily available to fit me. And that's not the case for a lot of folks. So that gives me a lot of privileges, even though I struggled a lot with my relationship to my body. There were a lot of physical and mental health issues in my family. So I was loved. I was supported. We had resources, all of those things. And one of the messages I received, so I grew up mostly in the 80s, was to stay small. And so, like, the messages aren't always overt, and they get sort of led into your life in different ways. I got the message that the higher the weight, the less lovable you might be. And I got this message. I got it from family. And I also want to say that my family, you know, was also a product of this socialization. So it wasn't mean-spirited in any way, but I would hear doctors and extended family members talk about my body in a way that was sort of fearful of what might happen. I was perhaps, when I look back at, you know, photos of myself, I'm like, gosh, why did I even have this perception of myself? I was a touch larger than my friends, but I really, you know, I look at these pictures and I think, oh, so sad that I even thought that I didn't fit, which again is not the point, right? The problem is that not everybody fits in our society, and we should have a society where everybody fits, right? And we meet people where they are. So I got these messages, right? These not so overt, and some of them overt, to stay small. And I also want to say, like, as a woman, we get these messages to stay small from our education, our government, magazines, pop culture, right? So there's a theme here, and so it felt big in a lot of ways, and it also felt like a big concept just in keeping my body small as a growing girl, right? So how often have we heard these phrases like, oh, he's a growing boy, he needs to eat, but girls get this message that they need to not grow. So that's a really common thing. My earliest memories of disordered eating were probably around 9. And what I found was the less I eat in front of others, the less shame I experienced. Like I felt like people were watching me and that there was some sort of critique happening. Maybe there was, maybe there wasn't. And I remember being 12 years old, and Wendy, you might remember this. So Squirrel Hill, we had a Jenny Craig at the corner of Forbes and Shady, and I was 12.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oh yeah, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yeah. There was a Jenny Craig weight loss center. I don't know if those exist anymore. And I was probably about 12 or 13. We had just moved to that part of the city, and I walked myself in with my babysitting money to this Jenny Craig. And they were very respectful. They were very kind. And they also called my mother. So, you know, they knew that I wasn't going to be doing that program, but I wanted to be. And, you know, there was a lot going on in my family and my household, and my parents, they didn't really talk to me about what motivated that or why I might want to lose weight or if I needed to lose weight. They offered me a gym membership to this women's gym. In hindsight, it was kind of a cool place looking back, because I could like walk to this women's gym. But you know, I was 13 years old, and the message I got was like, you know, it's not that you don't need to lose weight. It's more like you should work it off with exercise. So it was sort of solidified, and I was already dabbling in restriction. Fast forward, you know, through high school and all of that, nothing was like working. And I say that in air quotes. And my body was still slightly larger than my friends. In 1999, I was 20-ish, I think. And, I joined, Weight Watchers, and I always think, you know, the irony is not lost on me that I grew up with phrases like, well, I'm watching my weight, or you should watch your weight. Right. And then I like literally was like, I'm going to join this thing called Weight Watchers. And for me, that really, I was also receiving acupuncture at the time, as for the first time in my life, probably around 2021. And I was also getting messages to cut out larger food groups in the name of wellness. And you know, like I didn't eat pasta for 10 years. I just didn't eat pasta, right? So I look back and I would do these drastic things, and it was pretty under the radar, because the thing is if you're in a very thin body and you exhibit disordered behaviors, then you get care. But if you're in an average size body or any larger than an average size body, then you are applauded. So the behaviors are still disordered, but because of the body you're in, you're being the good fatty. I say that in air quotes, right? Like you're doing your job, because you should always be trying to get smaller. So anyway, I'm going to fast forward this. I spent a lot of years weighing myself. I documented my food until about until exactly May of 2017. And I documented every teaspoon. I looked normal from the outside. I looked like I was having a perfectly good time, but I was always counting in my head and documenting my food. And I discovered intuitive eating in 2004, and I literally came across this book in a People magazine while getting a pedicure. Literally came across this book. Some starlet was like, I have this really disordered relationship with food in my body, and this book really helped me. So I bought the book. It was probably like 2004 or whatever. You know, it created this desire to exit to find the exit ramp from diet culture, but like I didn't have community. And I didn't have, like, there were no podcasts. There were no, it was just like me and this paper book back, paperback book, which I still have, by the way, the original one, where I wrote all these notes in the margin. And I was living in Southern California, which we'll get to later. And so I just kind of had to be silent. Like these dietitians who wrote the book, they were saying all these really smart things, but they were radical, like, stop doing all of that diet stuff, stop tracking, you know? And so I tried really hard, but I couldn't let go of that piece until much later. I've been an acupuncturist for 16 years. Before that, I did massage therapy for 12, and I was a doula during that time. So I've been working with bodies for many years. And I think that covers my long story.
You have had such a journey, and thank you for sharing it with us. Before we even begin, I think I want to start with what is intuitive eating? What does that term even mean?
Yeah, so intuitive eating is actually an approach to eating, and it mirrors what we did as children if we were lucky enough to be left alone to eat, right? So picture your kids as 2-year-olds, and they're in their little high chair, and they have some grapes, some turkey, some cheese, and some crackers. Really easy to picture, right? And they eat a little bit of this, they eat a little bit of that. Maybe they have a little bit of the cookie, but they, they just kind of eat what they want to eat, and they raise their arms and they're like, "Get me out of this high chair! I want to go play." Right?
Yes.
So kids are not thinking through this. You put an adult in that, maybe not the height chair, a regular chair, and they have a plate with some turkey, some cheese, a cookie, some grapes, right? Same thing. And the adult is thinking through it, like, okay, well, depending on what's trending, maybe I eat the turkey and I'll have the fruit and that way I can have the cookie, right? Or I'll have the grapes, but I'm not going to have the cheese. I'm going to have it, right? So there's a lot of strategizing, and that might be for diet reasons, but that also might be for other health reasons. And when you're a kid, eating is like breathing. When you're a little kid, like toddler babies, eating is like breathing. It's like going to the bathroom. It's not something they're thinking about, and they know when they're hungry and they know when they're full. And they honor that. And so these two dietitians, Evelyn Tribbley and Elise Resch, who wrote the book Intuitive Eating, A Revolutionary Anti-Diet Approach, they wrote it first in 1995 after seeing so many people come through their clinics and feeling like they were on these diets, and maybe it was for weight loss, or maybe it was for blood sugar, or maybe it was for this, but whatever it was, they were feeling like they failed. And they weren't blaming the diets, they were blaming themselves. And so these two dietitians said, what if we get back to basics and talk about honoring hunger, honoring fullness, rejecting the diet mentality, embracing joyful movement and gentle nutrition rather than these very rigid ways of going about it? And could there be wisdom with some deep listening that we can glean from our bodies? And then we don't have to look externally to know what to eat. Our bodies already know it. And folks will sometimes say, if I did that, I would just eat cookies all day, every day. And the thing is you wouldn't. Because when you're going about this mindfully, and you're really thinking through it, and you're feeling your body's not going to tell you to eat cookies all day. Your body is going to tell you that it's okay to have a cookie at some point. This is way farther down the road because we've all been so programmed. And then they created a certification program, and then they certified me. So it was really in 2022 is when I went through that program with Evelyn Tribbley. And it was just, to have discovered that work in 2005 and have just been like on this lonely road by myself, and then found podcasts eventually in some community. To have her train me was just really cool. It was like,
wow,
meeting a hero. Yeah. And so, you know, they're I don't know how long they'll be doing this. So
you started, I mean, you've done so many things around wellness, from being a massage therapist to a doula to an acupuncturist. And are you now, explain to us how you're merging both of these things into your practice. And for those who aren't familiar with acupuncture, maybe just give a quick overview of what that is.
Very
quickly.
It's the oldest and most commonly practiced medical technique in the world. It's over 3,000 years old. We've sterilized, we use single use needles and that are sterilized, and then we just toss them. And what we do is we, again, really old medicine, but we see the body as having all these roadmaps. If you think of the New York subway, I like using this. If one train is down, the entire city is affected, right? And so we think of these thousands of acupuncture points on your body. If someone isn't functioning well, then the entire body suffers. And if we just open up the bottleneck there, or bring a little more nourishment to that spot, we can create change in the whole body. I think that's my little summation.
I think that works. Doesn't hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't hurt.
Anything that hurts won't hurt for longer than 3 seconds, or we take it out. So it's like, you might feel sensation. Some people don't feel pain at all with it. And but I'm someone who's always been pretty sensitive with the needles. And I always say, like, whatever's going on that brought you to acupuncture is far worse than this needle's going to be. So, and you're in control as the patient. So anything that hurts, we take it out. But 50% of them won't hurt at all. And maybe 25% will have some sensation. And maybe, you know, a few needles will be.
Yeah.
Seconds, really. Yeah.
I have a side tangent before we go on to the connection of both of them. Do people come to you for both? I mean, definitely physical health, but do people come to you searching for mental health support through acupuncture?
Absolutely. Yeah. I will say that I'm particularly good with working with folks with anxiety. And that's perhaps the gift of having had a lot of anxiety in my life and getting a lot of relief with acupuncture. So I treat a lot of folks who are searching for help with depression, anxiety, late stage recovery for eating disorders, which we're talking about in here, but that's definitely like not during the acute phase, and addiction, trying to quit smoking, that sort of thing, PMDD, PMS, so different menstrual issues that can affect the mood greatly for folks. So I do get a lot of that, and love treating from the mental health aspect.
Okay, that's a whole nother podcast that we should delve into sometime, Robin. Okay, so now tell us so it seems like it's a natural piece that these two might come hand in hand, but can you explain that? The
intersection? How I merge them and how I'm doing this?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it was, I had been doing this work on my own with the intuitive eating, and I didn't talk about it much with my, I started to find places where it was applicable to just mention it. But from 2010 until about 2020, I was just having this mindset on my own, treating people with acupuncture. And I wanted to merge them, but it made no sense to merge them. And when I say it made no sense is I didn't have a blueprint. I didn't know anyone doing this. I knew one acupuncturist in, I think she was in Cleveland, and she is an intuitive eating counselor and an acupuncturist, but it didn't look like she was merging them in a very deliberate way. 2020, the pandemic hit, and I closed my office for 9 weeks, which in the grand scheme of things was really small compared to like a lot of other businesses. For me, it was torture, and it was really scary not to be able to work and just be, you know, if I can't be in person, then I can't make money. And, you know, I didn't really even know there was a certification to become an intuitive eating counselor. I just thought, how can I merge all of this? And it really inspired me to do some research, and I found out, oh, there's this certification. And what if I just said that these two things go together? Even though I don't have a picture, because I know that they go together. And I'll say that in acupuncture school, we talked so much about trusting our bodies. So when there's pain, when there's GI upset, when there's anything, like, what does this body want? But when it came to food, the education was so prescriptive, and it didn't tap into this intuition. It was like, oh, there's no way you could know what to eat. And so I was firm, because of my work with intuitive eating, that we needed to align that trust also in the food department. So it was inspired, like, making this business, like rebranding it, was inspired by feeling really helpless in the pandemic, wanting a change, and wanting to bring this to folks, because I would hear things like, if I'd ask someone during an intake, what's your appetite like? Then the person might smile a little and say something like, oh, it's too good. You don't need to worry about that. Which, right, like, that's diet culture speaking. That's not, like, I actually want people to have an appetite. I want them to have an appetite for life, for food, and all that spans. And so I created 4 days a week. Starting in 2021, I would do acupuncture, and one day a week I started running these virtual groups, and they were intuitive eating 101. Was like, you know, if that's like a great intro, and I do it for businesses, or I do it for groups of friends, that sort of thing. But at the time, I was offering that once a month virtually. And then I started doing, if you people wanted to do more advanced work, going through the principles of intuitive eating, like principle number one, reject the diet mentality, principle number two, honor your hunger, etc. There's quite a few principles, and just giving people a deep dive, and then creating space for them at the end to talk to each other. And some of these people were not acupuncture patients, and many of them were, because that's how they got introduced to it through, I'd say, like, hey, I'm also doing this thing. But I don't merge them exactly together on the daily. If you've been doing intuitive eating work with me, I'm able to really do a little bit of extra coaching during my acupuncture sessions.
What does it look like when somebody comes and says, I want intuitive eating counseling? Like, is it typically a one-shot deal, or is it, you know, people come for weeks, like traditional therapy or counseling? How does that
what
work?
I usually recommend is, so we're doing a lot of deprogramming and curious work, right? Because it's different for everyone. So there's a lot of reflection that's involved. So typically how I do it is, I might see someone for an hour and a half session one-on-one. I'm doing more one-on-ones than groups at this point, but I do groups by request. And I'll see them, we'll go through a principle, and then I'll give them a little homework. Sometimes I give them some worksheets to fill out before, just so I can get a little picture of what's going on. And then I don't want to see them for another 3 to 4 weeks, usually 4 weeks, because this is slow work. I mean, it doesn't have to take everyone 20 years like it did me, because there are so many resources, but it's not a one and done. Because, for example, rejecting the diet mentality, which is the first principle of intuitive eating, and they put tons of research into why that's important. It's a really hard one to is a hard one to kick. So these things will take time, and then they all relate to each other, the different sessions. Usually after I see someone 10 times, you know, we just let it flow, and they're usually ready to fly and just live their life and apply these principles. And you know, me, an intuitive eating counselor, it's 2025 and I still check in with my own intuitive eating counselor because I have one. I did this work professionally, as a patient with a professional. And sometimes I need a little like, hey, can you remind me that my body's not broken and that everything's fine? And, you know, as we go through different stages in our life, like my midlife body is very different than my body in my 20s, my body in high school, and you know, whatever. So it takes there's some grief to that. Sometimes it takes some time to accept it all.
I'm giggling because I saw a meme yesterday about middle-aged bodies, and it was something like, can anyone else relate that they're a rotisserie chicken and they have to keep flipping in the middle of the night because this aches and that aches? And it made me laugh.
That's right.
It is true. It is true. Yeah, I have to flip a lot more than I did when I was 19 because this hurts or that hurts.
Yeah, it's like there's like that. There's so many levels that your body's just doing weird stuff. And it's like, okay, well, and now I have skin rash. All right, yeah. Cool. My left toe's swollen. Right. Let's just go with it. And it's like rapid onset change. And then sometimes these things stick around and then sometimes you just get a new one the next day. So I very much can see that meme being applicable. So
I'm going to ask you personally, because you've experienced yourself, and how has intuitive eating changed, you know, helped you? Like, how do you feel on a day-to-day basis versus how you felt when you were recording every little bite you ate? You know, just tell me how it feels, how you felt then, how you feel now, your mood, your well-being, your
strength,
all of that.
There was a big adrenaline piece. So I'm going to talk mostly about my 20s when things were at their worst. So there was an adrenaline piece and very high anxiety and hypervigilance. So if someone invited me for dinner back then, I'd cautiously go. I probably would have eaten a meal that felt acceptable to me before I went. And then, I would usually be counting in my head the whole time. So I wasn't very present. The chatter was just nonstop. And now I can go to a friend's I mean, it sounds so simple, and it is. It's just like the simple joy of I can go and experience someone making a meal with them, making a meal for me, and I can taste the love that was made in that meal, and I can experience the people and what we're talking about. And don't get me wrong, I played the part really well, right? Which was another thing I was managing. There was so much I was managing internally. But now I just feel like I couldn't have created body positive acupuncture, for example, in that disordered space, because there wasn't, between over-exercising and monitoring everything, there wasn't enough space in my head. And now I just have space. Like, there are moments where I'm not thinking about anything, and that is wild to me. So the sense of peace and presence and freedom, you know, that like diet culture was a life thief for me. So it stole my life. And from the outside, you know, I looked like I was doing great. But I wasn't really living fully, so I couldn't have created the bounty that I feel my life is now.
It's so cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So, Robin, you know, I have two girls, and you mentioned that it's a little different for girls than boys. And I do worry about this, about diet culture and body image and social media. And I do. And I'm sure many of our listeners do too. And maybe it is for boys too. Like, you know, and sometimes boy, I only have girls, and I only grew up with all girls. What advice do you have for parents who are raising kids today on how to best provide positive vibes when you're battling the whole culture, you know? So
you're battling the whole culture. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I also want to say I'm not a parent, but I've done a lot of work with parents on this subject. So I'd say, you know, most likely your kid's going to come to you at some point and say, I quote unquote feel fat, or I am fat, or I don't like my body. And then the parent is like, oh, no, 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 you're beautiful. Right. So this is like very common and it totally makes sense. Like you just want to soothe them and you just, you know, but you're also operating on the message that you think that fat and beautiful are opposites. Right. And that's just from socialization that we got as, you know, our generation. So when you try to kind of make that word go away, I think that, that can send a message that you didn't mean to send. So I think neutralizing the word fat, talking about body diversity and how there are all kinds of bodies, right? Why am I, Tyler Federer?
Yes.
Who wrote Federer? I think Cool Bodies, yeah. Right? That book. Yes. So like having some books with different kinds of bodies around. And also there's tons of resources now. There are books called there's a book called How to Raise an Intuitive Eater. But I think neutralizing the word fat, talking about how that isn't an insult, and changing the culture in your home is really helpful. Also, the message is like what I heard my parents saying about their bodies really affected me. Even if it was in jest, I got the message that like, oh, they're monitoring, so I should be monitoring, and also they might be monitoring me. So when you speak about something, maybe it's how you look in some way that has nothing to do with your weight or has something to do with your weight, your kids are hearing it. So really just having a firm line, and with other people that come to your house, like if they talk about diet culture or you're just getting a hint, you're probably right if that's what you think you're hearing. So I simply say, oh, don't talk about food that way. Or I don't talk about bodies that way. And that's pretty much a conversation ender. Like, it's like, okay, we should talk about something else. So I think really, and then talking about it with your kids, you're not going to introduce an eating disorder by talking to your kids about body image issues.
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing I would say is like food policing. You know, it's really hard if you've seen your kid eat a ton of, I don't know, let's say cotton candy, and then get a really bad stomach ache. So then the next time that they are going to do that, you want to be like, you're going to get a stomach ache, you know, or whatever it is, or that's bad for you if you eat too much. Like the thing is like, I have learned so much from a stomach ache. So if you let your kids just go, like maybe vegetables just aren't vibing with them for a certain number of years, it's okay. Like what's most important is the relationship to food, because they have a whole life in front of them to nourish it in very specific ways. Let them explore. Maybe they don't have to clean their whole plate. You know, like that's not helpful when you're full, for example, if you're just following an external rule. So getting curious, if you don't know, say less, find some books, find some resources.
That was helpful. Thank you. I'm going to remember those things. Good. So I really appreciate it. First off, where can people learn more about you? And if they are not a Baltimorean, did I say it right? If they're not a Baltimorean,
I think so.
Baltimorean. Yeah. and they want to learn more about intuitive eating, who are listening, people listen at, from all over on our podcast. So where can they find you? And two, where can they, learn more? Like, what is there, like an association of intuitive eaters or some book or, you know, whatever it might be,
yeah,
that you yeah. recommend? Robin Harris.
So you can find me on Instagram at Body Positive Acupuncture, though I don't know for how long, because social media is feeling Real weird. Anyway, I'm on there right now. Bodypositiveacupuncture.com. I work with folks from all over, so I can work with them one-on-one virtually, or like I said, create some groups, or sometimes employers want to just have like a one-on-one. And I think this is a great replacement for a lot of workplace wellness programs that are like, really they're creating sort of a big Biggest Loser type of thing, and that's really not great for folks. So what if we just taught them about getting back in tune with their bodies? That's like much more about wellness. Intuitiveeating.org, there are a lot of resources on that website, and plenty of studies, as over 100 evidence-based studies. And you can, there's also a directory of providers. And there's also ASDA, which is the Association for Size Diversity, and they are really, really wonderful. And they also have a directory, and they really vet who they put on there. So you can find me there. You can find me on intuitiveeating.org, but you can also just get a ton of resources, research. And I'm sure you're going to have some show notes where we can put some of these books. So there's Anti-Diet by Christy Harrison. If you just love, 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 studies, there's tons of those. Fat Talk by Virginia Soulsmith, which is great for parents, as well as How to Raise an Intuitive Eater. And I also want to say that I didn't get into this piece because it was too big for this podcast, but there are a lot of intersections between BMI, the body mass index, and race. And I couldn't have possibly delved into them, but I want to throw out there The Body is Not an Apology by Sonia Renee Taylor. And that's a really great book for, I mean, everyone who's read it, it's really wonderful the way it brings the political and the personal together. Fearing the Black Body by Deshaun Harrison, or Dr. Sabrina Strings, and The Belly of the Beast by Deshaun Harrison. All of these authors talk about the ways anti-fatness is actually anti-Blackness. And so again, I didn't get into it because it's so big, but really important stuff there. And so if you're kind of like, I was never really a dieter and I don't know why this is important, if you're interested in race politics, as I think we all should be, then it's great to explore some of those Black authors.
Robin, you rock. I am so grateful that you agreed to talk to me this morning and the No Shame on You podcast and all of our listeners. And I just am impressed with you. You inspire me. You're an awesome woman. You have the best vibes ever. She's also really stylish and cool. And I love her that too about her. But I'm just so grateful. Thank you for spending the morning with us.
Thank you for having me. This is my first podcast. It was an honor. Loved it.
You rocked it. We're going to do something else. All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time. Bye, Robin.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for tuning into the No Shame on You podcast. If today's episode resonated with you, be sure to connect with us on all social media platforms. Explore our free resources at www.noshameonyou.org. That's the letter U, not YOU.org. Remember, every action counts in our mission to end stigma and save lives. Together, we can make a difference. Until next time, take care and stay inspired.